so I think the most direct thing is a text called The Lathe of Heaven. The Lathe of Heaven?
Yeah.
By Ursula Le Guin, and it's like this brilliant, I don't know, again, it's like a very small book, right? Very short, but like almost a novella, right? And the main character has these dreams, which are what the novel calls effective. They end up changing reality. And, you know, as he goes to see a therapist to try to get some relief and some understanding of what's happening to him and maybe assurance that he's not insane, the therapist ends up like, you know, sort of like using his dreams, right, to situate himself in more and more kind of powerful positions in society, and he says all these idealistic things about we're going to make the world better, but it's like it's clear the world's sinking into this like dystopia. But it kind of takes a strange turn. I don't want to reveal too much of it, right? Like I think the bare outlines may be enough for us to like start analyzing a little bit. And again, I know you've not experienced the work, but like I would at least maybe advise people to check it out. It's absolutely amazing. Ursula Le Guin is a fantastic author. And again, it's like I think one of the questions about metaphysics of dreaming, you know, like maybe teasing apart some of the psychoanalytic questions, would be, I think there's genuine like phenomenology of dreams kind of problems about like, not merely this kind of solipsistic question of like, how do you know you're not in a dream or, you know, like,
the Cartesian question.
These series of Cartesian questions. And mm-hmm. I don't want to reduce them to banality, right? Like, because like there is a sense in which like all of contemporary thinking like circulates within the boundaries, like within Descartes' dream, right? We're still thinking in that, according to that mode or tone of like possible thought configurations, right? That try to differentiate themselves precisely by the way they're not dreams and like try to, but I guess it's easy to recognize the shape of Descartes' answer as like kind of a failure, right? Like by sort of demanding a transcendental verification, that you're not caught up in a hallucination. I don't know. At least it seems to like just raise the question, kick the can to another level, right? Like you need a meta verification that the verification is valid, right? Like you sort of are never at the end of validating it.
Right. The process of doubt never ceases.
Right. And like, I mean, maybe this is, I feel like the end of Inception kind of circles around this question of like the mm-hmm. literally unfilmable like problem of like whether or not what you're seeing is a dream, right? Like of course everything in that's constructed upon a stage is like a kind of collective dream, I guess. And like, I don't know. I mean, I guess that's where I think there's like a bridge, because it's like in psychoanalysis, a dream is a kind of hieroglyphics, right? Which we're like patiently decoding according to the kind of strata of language that like ended up embedded in it, you know, and we can kind of pick apart. It's not really a language, but it's like a language, you know what I mean? Rebuses and puns and the strange logic of dreams, right? That like, I think this is maybe the really, you know, excellent gift of psychoanalysis is to like give us a lot of the like specifics of like how dream logic kind of functions. And like to conduct a concrete analysis of specific contemporary dreams and like, and to try to relate it back to the subjects that dreamed them. But I mean, it's clear it presumes a lot metaphysically, I guess would be the thing, you know, that, that dreams are kind of like simply a neural set of like have this, I mean, obviously dreams are like realized neurally, right? Like, but you know, it papers over, I think, the epistemological problems, I guess, with delimiting the edges and boundaries of the dream. And I mean, precisely because like through the, like to mean, again, to some degree, all collective social formations are like, have this hallucinatory or semi-fictional aspect. This is sort of maybe even what sets Homo sapiens apart, is this ability to like fabulate and make up a fake, like, you know, game or world and play along as though it is real. Right. I don't know, this would kind of be a series of questions about like the theater maybe, and like the nature of acting. And I think this maybe gets us to the real philosophical territory about dreams, which like Nietzsche is kind of, I would say, is like maybe our Onironaut or something for us to analyze here. Cause he clearly has a different take on dreaming. That's like psychological without kind of reducing the dream back to the subject that dreamed it, but like piercing through this, like recognizing that, I don't know, there's something of a vector to all of subjectivity or all the names of all the subjects, you know, that I don't want to suggest it's like revealed only in dreams or something, but that like, I don't know. There definitely is a depersonalization that occurs in dreaming. Right. But at the same time, it's like, it's really obvious that you're building them. You know what I mean? That it's like, that it's this part of you that's constructing it. And I don't know. I mean, like, I guess just like there's recent sleep research in general that's like sort of talking about like how valuable sleep and dreaming are to like social integration and cohesion and to individuals being able to integrate into society successfully and to take the things other people say and like in a broad and understanding and comprehensive way. And I mean, there's something about social integration and dreaming that's like an important connection that I would just maybe underline. It's an interesting fault line, you know, the kind of that psychoanalysis maybe runs roughshod over in a way that Nietzsche's kind of thinking about the relation of dreams to reality and the problems of like sort of theater and acting and fiction as they relate to sort of the great game of society and the series of masks and costumes we wear. And yeah, I don't know. Like, I mean, I guess the real question here, maybe the Guattarian one, is about the collective unconscious and the dreams that we are all kind of having. And I don't know if Guattari ever formulates it this way, but like, you know, how could it be possible for us to have, for us to interrogate our collective dreams about, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's one of these things, right? Like there's this in breaking down in the collapse of social forms. It's like, there's this gap that opens up and something new is possible. But like Nietzsche says, the horizon's like kind of, it's blank and empty, right? So because you get to fill it in, there's this creative process in the gap, right? Between a given social form and the next one. I don't know. I guess I'm just thinking about like fixity and fluidity now, you know, in the way I think Bachelard has a book about kind of dreams and water, right? He does these kind of elemental analyses of different kind of aspects of the psyche, right? Kind of ones, there's ones about like kind of dwelling and poetry and, which now that I say it has a weirdly Heideggerian ring, but it's like not that kind of work somehow. But it's called The Poetics of Space is one of them. But like, he's got another one about psychoanalysis of fire, but he's got the book, I think it's Water and Dreams. Am I wrong about this?
Bachelard? No, that's right. This? Yeah. He's also got a book on air. There's almost a
air. So he's got the full elemental cycle.
Yeah. There's a kind of pre-Socratic Ionian type of, you know, contemplating of the elements going on there in that series.
But I guess the suggestion is that dreams like can prophesize new social forms, can like, you know, can offer us a foretaste of things to come. And when they become like ominous or again, like banal and, you know, I don't know, like we should investigate the specific character of the dreams that our culture and our bodies participate in. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure why I'm like wanting to immediately make this like a kind of a techno-political task of like and collectively analyzing not like our literal dreams, maybe I should say, right? But like, but the collective constructions and fictions that bind us together, and maybe identity is the central one that like maybe the literal process of dreaming breaks down, right? And lets us reconfigure into a more broad, comprehensive, kind of capacious kind of thing, right? I guess I'm really just arguing for better sleep and for people to I don't know. And what do you think? Dreaming and social integration and dreaming as a kind of fluidity that presages new forms of social fixations? And
well, I mean, if you look at ancient literature, this is, even in the most ancient literature, this is true of dreaming. I'm thinking of the one of the oldest epic poems we have, the Sumerian epic Gilgamesh, right? And the whole plot of the story starts with Gilgamesh having become a sort of this emperor warrior over his society, over his city of Uruk, and the men of his town, the men of his city are crying out for justice because this king has asserted the right to prima nocta, right? To the right of the despot to claim first right, first priority in the mating rituals, and so he's essentially trying to make it such that the firstborn are all his, because he's, at least in the story, he's two-thirds god, one-third man, in this interesting amalgamation. So the townspeople cry out about this injustice, and his mother intervenes, because potentially, one believes, potentially to keep a revolt or some other kind of violent uprising from occurring, long story short, Gilgamesh, in the story Gilgamesh, there's two important dream sequences. Now, the interpretation of the dreams are very straightforward, but the important thing is that both of them have to do with setting Gilgamesh on this different route than merely ruling his town with an iron fist. The first dream, he has presages this coming of this sort of man animal that will come and challenge him, etc. It turns out to be his who will be his best friend Enkidu, and the way Enkidu is described, he is sort of he's both sort of man, woman, animal, beast. He is the kind of primordial substrate from whence humanity arises. And he goes to talk to his mom about the dream, and his mom basically interprets it for him and tells him that this will shape his destiny. And they end up, there's a famous scene where they end up wrestling and they become best friends, and that sets him off on his journey, on this journey towards his death, it's towards Enkidu's death, which is, it's this journey towards, one could say, conquering the, or integrating this primordial bestial element of human animality and its history. But it's very close to the story Freud tells in Totem and Taboo about the father hoarding all the women, right? And the brothers collaborating to kill him, except here that eventuality is forestalled or precluded by the mother, this mother figure, who this goddess who in order to keep her son from being, you know, deposed, counsels with the gods, and actually they craft Enkidu because Gilgamesh is missing something. He's missing these other essential halves, one could say, of the human, which is precisely the prehistorical, the one could say the pre-individual, but also the female and the male, or the animal and the human, and all of these things that get arbitrarily separated and binarized. And later on, he has another dream, but it's about they go on this quest. Long story short, that's the dreams are you could say they're just literary devices, and they are in the story, but it's all about integrating, but the whole purpose for the dreams is about this social problem and solving these trans individual problems of the city that is in turmoil. So, yeah.
No, I love that. It's making me think about Oedipus and Colonus, right? And the way his death is going to protect the city, which always feels very obscure to me, right? It's like, it's because he's a holy man or something, because these awful things have happened to him. It kind of makes his dead body kind of a holy thing. And he's like, he is a hero. He's like a great, like, Oedipus is like this great adventurer too, in his way, you know, and this conqueror and this king and all this stuff. You just, you know, the House of Atreus just falls on very hard and gross times, right? But I think, and maybe I'm making this up, which would be perfect too, but there's a vision or a dream of a sacred grove that Oedipus sees as he's like wandering around blind. And somehow he knows he's there. He knows that's where the fates live, where the Furies are. And he like says, can I live here and like protect Greece with my death? And it's like, it's a very weird, like occulty kind of thing maybe. Right. But it's like part of Oedipus's redemption and his reintegration into society, even if that can only happen through this expiation of death, making his corpse a kind of holy thing, right? Which kind of brings to mind Antigone, who's like compelled to this like almost dreamlike fate of like living death and like living burial, but like, and I, it makes me uncomfortable even thinking about it, right? It's like, it's so awful, and but she's like such a brilliant hero, and like every line of hers is like glowing with her like resistance to like tyranny,
right
and it, she's just brilliant. But yeah,
the other aspect of in ancient literature of dreams and social problems is, you know, dreams have very interesting, they work very in a very interesting way in ancient, or in the Old Testament, right? So I'm thinking of,
Joseph.
Joseph has he helps solve the what is it,
king's dreams,
right? Is it Nebuchadnezzar, supposedly? I'm trying to remember if that was the king at the time.
I think he's much later. It was Egyptian, right? It was Nebuchadnezzar. Yeah,
no, I'm thinking that was Daniel, sorry.
That sounds right. Yes,
but there was something similar too, where but it's about the well-being, the future of the of the empire, or at least the main cities, and the seven fat calves and seven skinny calves, you know, those dreams and potentially they can't be solved because by any of the seers and prophets, because they are so directly tied to the future of the colony, of the society, and it takes an outsider to see it, right? It, you know, Joseph is he's the outsider that's become the insider, you know, and the whole story of Egypt and the Israelites, you know, culminating with with Joseph is not
Moses.
Well, with that's true. It culminates in a different way there, right? But yes, so you can definitely see this, I think, very clearly, and I'm sure there's many other examples we could bring up with the role of in ancient literature. It seems much more clearly tied that the most important dreams are not ones recited but seated behind a couch, right? They are the ones that need to be recorded have to do with the fate of civilizations.
Yeah, no, I love that aspect of Joseph's interpretations of the dreams as having to do with the future well-being, mm-hmm. and really about climate. That's the element that's leaping out to me right now, is
right.
the way in which
right.
it records a like civilizational level like catastrophe and collapse, right?
That's right. That's right.
And pointing to 7 years of fallow farmland, that's not great. That's
7 years of drought. Yeah, that's
No, that's a disaster. And that's a huge scale natural disaster that's like copied in this, it's captured only in this, I don't know. I mean, like, it's interesting the Bible captures this all of these like natural events, but does so in this like kind of dreamlike, transfigured way. I don't know.
Sure. Oh yeah. And I was going to suggest that, you know, it's interesting that some of the earliest, the oldest dated writings we have isn't Gilgamesh, even though that's the oldest epic we have, but the oldest Sumerian writing we have, if, you know, insofar as we date it as some of the oldest writing, it's just scribes tallying grain harvests, right? Mm-hmm. So the importance of writing as Deleuze and Guattari say in Anti-Oedipus, and I'm sure they weren't the first to say it, but it writing becomes important, necessary with the needs of empire, right? And with the needs of this taking stock is only gets to that point at the stage of the despotic regime. And so, yeah, I just think that the taking stock of the grain and what grain, what harvests, taking stock of the harvests, it ties back into
that's
the dreams about the cows.
No, I mean, for the Sumerians, that's like the economy. It's like cattle and corn.
Yes,
you know what
that's
I mean?
Right.
Like that's the good stuff, right?
And the term capital, as you know, comes back to the word for cow, right? And
yeah, not surprising at all to me, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
But I guess the thing, I'm thinking about the insider-outsider thing a little bit, and uh-huh. how it's like someone that only had visited the Nile Delta once every 15 years, right, might be able to catch sight of the transformations, you know, the problems that large-scale irrigation was producing, right?
Right.
Like the impact of the empire on the land, right?
Right.
Like what could only be glimpsed at these like extremely long intervals, right? That may be too long even for a human generation of the era, right?
That makes sense.
It's like you're the water's boiling, you know, and you're just stuck in it. And it's funny, I feel like we're facing a similar, you know, set of problems today, and like it's on us to dream up a new future. I guess that's like one of the senses here of the like the social dreaming, like would be, you know, like it seems like dreams can foretell new social structures, right? Like I guess this would be the real suggestion, that it's like it's the basic form of like world modeling, right? That precedes, you know, I mean, it like, I guess I'm just talking about like at some level, just imagination, but it does seem like that there's something particularly revolutionary, like specifically revolutionary about dreams. Right. And I think this is maybe the insider outsider sense of Joseph's interpretation of the Pharaoh's dream, right?
Mm-hmm.
That
yeah.
it's, I think you said it this way, that like the existing advisors were too caught up in justifying the structure of the existing system and only interested in forecasting infinite growth to catch yes. sight of the coming collapse that they needed like that. To protect themselves against. Yeah.
Who wants to tell the Pharaoh the bad news?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things. And that's what the revolutionary in some ways can do, right? Is like mobilize the population. Because that would be the danger, right? Like of an advisor discovering that the there was going to be a collapse would be that they could gather political power and, whatever, use the crisis to their advantage or something.
Yes. Right. So
it wouldn't, I don't know. There's something about it's like difficult to talk openly about like dangerous things that can happen. Like it's a general thing. It's like any human enterprise shares this problem of psychological safety, yeah. You know what I mean? And it like it being okay to like talk about mistakes that the organization is making and or that the group, or just like, find ways for the group to improve, right? Like, and be in a mindset where it's about like learning and growth and not anxiety or too cozy or, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like there's a thing about like, just in general, how do we form effective, like assemblages and teams and groups of people in such a way that they can, yeah, I don't know.
One of the things you were bringing it to was, I mean, you were linking it not only to modern times or postmodern times to current times and issues, but also linking the drought with climate. And there's something to be said about, Marx's postulation, prediction, claim that capitalism functions via crises, right? And it seems that the current advisors, if we stick with the analogy, would point out that, well, it's all about making sure the crises aren't so bad or like incrementally making capitalism better. And then there's perhaps the other forecast of the imminent destruction of all life on Earth and the underlying factor being capitalism in its modes of production, that a more drastic undertaking would have to be dreamt of, which is why, I haven't read Zizek in a long time, but I still remember his adage that it's easier to, and we see this in cinema very much so, and in literature, it's easier to depict the end of the civilization in an apocalyptic vein, right, with zombies and other kinds of disasters, than it is to think of the end of capital and capitalism. That's the dream you were kind of hinting at.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think this would be like the real dream would be like, and it's the one that everyone's like afraid to try to directly formulate for, and like that's loaded with all this anxiety and insanity, right? Like of like trying to, and we call, I mean, it's like, it's called utopianism, right? Marxians get called, utopian idealist for attempting to mess with like the structure of the social fabric.
Right.
Of course, every reactionary is going to be against revolution. I mean, in some way, all of it's like too predictable. But I mean, I think there's like a biophysical element here. That would be the thing that you're making me think of, is that like the structure of industrial civilization is such that we're all too exhausted and anxious to be able to dream effectively about,
or too plugged in.
Yeah.
I mean, this would, in a certain way, make Deleuze and Guattari utopian, right? By rejecting Oedipus as a solution, because Freud, I mean, to a certain extent, at the end of his life, at least, Freud, with the model of the neurotic as the model adapted, let's say, interminable patient, like adjusted to enjoy their symptom, as Lacan might say, to the mode of production of, modern Austrian capitalism, or who knows, we could say American capitalism today, with Deleuze and Guattari saying that's a stopgap, right? That's just a way of making one accept the fate of the, well, it's making one reactionary, to put it in the terms that you brought, right? That there's something counter-revolutionary about what Freud was doing with proposing Oedipus as a universal structure. Whereas in his roots, Freud's proposals about the unconscious, his proposals about what the dream was doing, not just what it was, what it meant, but what it actually, the work it effectuates in its in the dream work. There's something revolutionary about that, or there's something revolutionary hinted at work in desire, as they would say. Because I do think that Freud in his, and they even put this in a certain way, that in his proposals in the early days with the three essays on sexuality, there's a lot of the things that Freud is proposing that is very disturbing to genteel Victorian bourgeois sensibility. But in the end of the day, there's something that he, it's like he sees his work to become to just co-adapt subjects to the dominant mode of production or subjectivity, whatever. I think that's what drives, if there's like one guiding thread throughout schizoanalysis or anti-Oedipus, it's rejecting that later complacency, I would say, of Freud to just adapting subjects to the current mode, to the dominant powers that be.
And today, to the hyper-connected dream time of, like, you know, this global media. But like, I that was the thing I was linking. At first I thought you would say, like, can we do without, Deleuze is saying, can we do without this incessant connectivity? And it's funny that that's like one way of understanding Oedipus, is like this neurotic need to constantly connect and be validated and affirmed. And you know what I mean? That this is like one of the things Oedipus is about, is this weird, like, broken desire within us to bug other people and to monitor them, judge them, and to like arrange society and stratify it. Right. Like,
right.
That's what microfascism is. And that's, I think, why both the left and the right seem to be touching a hot stove when they're like, let me tamper with, you know what I mean? Like the kind of the knobs and tweak the social fabric in any way. Like, all conservatives are going to be like, well, look, it's brand new. We don't know the results. We don't know what can happen. Which, like, look, is like, just to be super clear, it's not an evil position, right?
No, it's not. It's all too rational or something.
Exactly. No, so I'm not necessarily trying to like argue for or against like the reaction and conservatism. But it's more like we need to enable the possibility, the conditions of possibility for dreaming life otherwise. And I mean, I think you said it well. It's like the dreaming the future of life at all. At least as we, you know, as we know and love it, right? Like, you know, big fuzzy mammals and, you know, healthy trees and in a healthy planet.
There's something about, is it that way? I'll let you finish, but it was the question of connectivity. There's something to this that I think is akin to the problems that accelerationism faces. Connectivity is kind of, on the one hand, a kind of opiate and a neuroticizing element, but on the other hand, if accelerated enough or taken to a certain limit, can it not push the process fast enough? I think it's not a paradox, but this is the problem too in anti-Oedipus. Again, it's, you know, this limit, this axiomatizing limit of capitalism to always subsume these previously unsubsumable domains. Guattari says it well enough. It's not that we have too many little baubles and gadgets. It's that we need more and more, and we need a hyper hyper-produce, hyper-connect, hyper-disjoin, and at a certain, you know, maybe at least theoretically unforeseeable limit, there's either collapse or there's some sort of event, one could say, and perhaps that is the extinction of the human race, or that is some sort of apocalyptic moment. Is to put Zizek's question a different way, is the end of capitalism only possible with the end of civilization? And what do we mean by ends, right? This is Derrida's question. Yeah.
Right. No, well, yeah, I was going to try to jump in on that because it's like,
oh, please do. Yeah.
I mean, like, this is like, I think one of the ways that Nagar Astani framed the problem is about something that Rodin talks about, which is David John Rodin, talks about like a disconnection between our like local transcendental structure of experience and like the possible iterations of post-humanity and these deep technological futures. That is what acceleration would like us to reorient around, is like keeping open the conditions of possibility for these wild futures that like could await us if we don't fuck it up. Right. Like, so, I mean, it's sort of that sense about like, you know, let's try to toss the golden ball forward that life has tossed to us and like keep things going. And keep, you know, I don't know. That's at least like the green thing I think about, which is just like, there's ecological continuity and we have to maintain it. And so it like raises objection to the idea of like a fundamental kind of psychological or, you know, whatever, like transcendental experiential kind of like discontinuity between us and our descendants. And, you know, again, if we end up having them, I think the idea is that it's like, if we're going to transform the structure of experience and like create a science of minds and like be able to create like new minds, then we'll have to have like concrete elements and like a theory of the mind to do that. It won't be just like, we'll hopefully understand enough about the process, right? That it won't be like, structurally will not be possible to create some super AI that like we don't understand at all. You know what I mean? And it's like, greater intelligence could, like in a better theory of the mind, could let us like mutate and tamper with the transcendental structures of experience, which is like a much more radical revolution in some ways than anything kind of like merely temporal political or something. There's like kind of an unworldly idealism of possible minds or something. It's like this, it's a resumption of speculative idealism kind of like augmented by like neuroscience and, you know, advanced super science of all kinds. Right. But yeah, I don't know. I was kind of trying to react to the idea of disconnection. And I mean, another way Nagar Astani says it is that like the idea of the human, and the name human even is like a transferable property that like, you know, we can't just by calling ourselves inhuman or post-human, we don't actually get rid of being human. So you know what I mean? So I don't know. It's like, I think the point there is it's easy to label, you know, possible deep technological future iterations of minds as like, you know, alien, gods or something, but it's like, they would have this like clear line of descent. And like, if we're engineering the minds, we have a solid, at least enough practical understanding of the elements of it to like not make it utterly disconnected. Right. And it's not like, I don't know. Well, so Nagar Astani ends up throwing a lot of water on like the super intelligence, you know, explosion danger scenarios. And he's trying to revitalize like a more serious, genuine interest in it. And like, anyway, I don't know.
I think that this is an important point to make, this question of a nominalism, of a naming. This is when this question is, I'm thinking of Badu's Being an Event. I mean, this question of the event and the eventual site, naming that multiple, and the question of whether or not fidelity to the event is not itself an event, right? If the event is not double in its own structure. So I agree with that point that, yeah, we can call it whatever we want, but it's not, that's not enough. And I do agree with that, but there's something about fidelity to the, not just, I mean, there obviously the Reza's point, Nagaristani's point is important. I mean, obviously one has to engineer the, one has to take the sciences seriously. One, the event, so to speak, has to be out there. But for Badu, the event will not have been shown to be a part of the situation without the fidelity. Does that make sense? There's almost a kind of a catch 22, right? Without the fidelity to the event naming the eventual site, and seeking out the connectivities of that multiple that has not yet been shown to be a part of the situation, then to a certain extent, the event, if it will not have the consequences that it would have had alone, right? That's the thing. And so obviously it goes beyond merely you coming up with new names or multiplying the names, of the post-human, the inhuman, et cetera. But there's something powerful to that as well. And following the consequences of a sort of a fidelity to, seeking out the connectivities for what these conceptual placeholders can mean and do.
Yeah, no, the thing you made me think is about like deterritorialization, and like in principle there would be nothing like to stop a divergence, right? Like and I guess it would sort of become a question of like, when does a psychological gulf between intelligences become like unnavigable or unbridgeable? And I guess the suggestion is if they share a common lineage, in principle, you could reconstruct, but like, I think that our interactions with like dolphins and so on are enough to like prove that we can't necessarily reconstruct like a total communicative thing, that it's like, you can diverge far enough to become genuinely disconnected, that like evolution has both of these aspects. And when you're dealing with like deep time, it does seem possible. I mean, at the very least, it seems like you could escape the Earth with a band of humans and just go live on Mars. And after generations, you would have diverged and you might not be the same species. You could still understand each other, but you can imagine escaping now for, you know, 5,000 or 500,000 years or something, right? And coming back. And now there might be a psychological gulf with like super, you know, these various sciences having developed in different, like, again, like the ability to re-engineer the mind, right? Like in principle, it seems like that space is pretty large, like what right. The space of possible minds could be. And it seems like, yeah, like whatever, if like uplifted dolphins, you know, escaped the Earth and then came back, like, you know, millions of generations later, right? Like presumably there's a disconnect, right? And again, it seems like the same thing would be true of humans or AIs or something like this. That at least in principle, it's possible to form a disconnect. But I guess if you're a proper Kantian, like we can even talk to aliens. You know what I mean? Like the
structure of intelligence is universal
or transcendental. Anyway, we could work out a means of doing it. You know what right. I mean? Like, you know, even if it is like, has to start from like pure mathematics or something like this. And it feels like that's the direction most sci-fi kind of takes around the disconnection kind of thesis, right? That it's like our psychological gulf with, you know, an alien intelligence, you know, could be bridged mathematically because math has this weird transcendental character. It like, you know, connects with these pure forms of numbers that are outside of the universe. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, I guess that would be the suggestion. Like math is kind of a language that all intelligence kind of can share because it's like just, I don't know, like I don't want to say math is just anything, I guess, but like, yeah, Yeah, I don't know. I mean, obviously, like the specific elements of like real mathematics don't seem like they would necessarily correlate, right? Like this is Neal Stephenson and Anathem has a kind of a funny sort of exploration of this, where this ship is like kind of hopping between universes, like through the, like is found some way to traverse the multiverse, and like it takes place in this universe where like all of the same mathematics has been discovered, but it's like got different names because it was different named individuals who discovered the things, but the principles are the same. So, I mean, it would be this, it would be about like just translating the names or something. Right. Like again, that works because it's both humans, but you can imagine an alien civilization that has totally different predicates. Or again, like David John Brennan does not seem wrong that you could generate like a real psychological gulf, especially if you start by disconnecting, if you like unplug from the cultural dream time of your like, you know, host parent culture. This is how minorities are engineered. This is how like minorization works, right? Like is by a form of disconnection, right? Like, and it's often imposed brutally and violently, right? I guess we should like spell that out, right? That like disconnection is a, at least in existing human societies, is most often come about like these different entirely different frames of mind that are basically mutually unintelligible, right? Like come about through stratification, you know? And I don't know. Like, I feel like this is one of the things we're dealing with today politically, maybe just to bring it back to that and to, you know, it's not that reactionaries are like comfortable with the predations of capital necessarily. You know what I mean? Like, I guess some of them are, but it's more like they feel like they're, I don't know. I mean, I guess that's the thing. It's like when people feel like they're losing, it's like they're willing to try to do something new, right? Mm-hmm. Especially someone who's claiming they can bring lots of winning and victory and good feelings to them and entertain them, you know? I mean, honestly, this is like, I think we're living through like social media eating the world and, you know, like kind of, it really is this like final, you know, sublimation of entertainment and business and politics all into one kind of unholy conglomerate. And yeah, disconnecting from it seems like important, but also like fatal, you know what I mean? Like, and if it's imposed on us, it's going to be violent. You know what I mean? I really worry about the dangers to like the free circulation of ideas and communication and the press. And, you know, for a long time, I thought that was one of the things, you know, Theory Talk was vaguely doing, was like helping circulate ideas and thinking and open up alternate possibilities and function as kind of a shared associative dream time for us to, you know, envision new things.
Well, that's one. I mean, that's one aspect of ideally what we are doing here. If we were going to get a little meta, you know, if we're going to be meta discursive about what we are.
Yeah, no, sorry. I know that's probably too much.
Well, no, it's not a, I mean, Theory Talk sometimes needs to not just talk about theory, but talk about its practice, right? What we are putting together out of these sort of chaotic elements of our own stream of consciousness is perhaps a performance of these disparate elements that do not always have to cohere. I mean, many times in the conflict of the forces comes the enactment of hopefully of thinking, but you know, when thinking fails to reach its goal, when thinking doesn't happen, when there is a, I mean, that's apparent, but there's also this question of a force of thought, right? Of a violence that by which thinking is sort of forced to set its engines going, you know, whether or not that affects others trans individually can't be our preoccupation. I think that's obviously, you know, and I read something interesting, some article about, you know, you can remember, I'm sure, as I can, as kids, the whole question about what do you want to be when you grow up was always a sort of a concrete question. It was always subsumed with the question of what do you want to be? What do you want to do? What do you want to be? Right? Your job becomes the subjectification, the hailing of the subject that you will coincide with, which always I found slightly problematic, but today, or at least there's a trend that more and more, one of the answers to this question is YouTube personality or an even sort of more monstrous name for it would be a trendsetter, or what's the word I'm looking for? Not trendsetter, influencer. But influencer. Yes, that's the word. Thank you. And whether or not I think that's to be meta-discursive about what we're doing, you know, to be wrapped up in, you know, who or how, well, who or how many one influences is perhaps less important than merely the process of,
totally. Yeah.
Of influencing. Absolutely. One, insofar as we influence one another, if others get swept up in that current, then that should show the quote unquote authenticity of what we're doing. I mean, and whether or not what we're doing is authentic is perhaps almost a fascist question. It's because that's not the point. Does it work? Does it work? You know, we work together?
No, it obviously works. And, but I want to defend the point just real quick. And this can be the last thing, but like, it will be about this multivalence of the word association that links together the psychological and the political. Right. And so it's about, at the level of dreaming, right? Like, how can we form new associations, right? That let us like link up the world differently and see how things came together differently and integrate society differently. But the flip side of that is like, what you know, one of the core Marxist demands is free association, right? And that coincidence always seems fascinating to me, right? Because it's about being able to freely associate, you know, both within your strata and to be able to gain power that way and to form, you know, like effective minorities that can like advocate for themselves and wield power and like gain a seat at the table. And, you know, if you start unionizing and advocating for yourselves, you will get a seat at the table. You will put points on the board. You know what I mean? Like, you will start racking up wins. You know, that's how to do it. It's to like form assemblages and work together and find ways to build new lines of association between us. And it's not that we have to have a bunch of theoretical content to do that, right? Like, you know, I think it's obviously the case that most movement activists, you know, don't necessarily need a big theoretical apparatus to apply their practice. You know what I mean? And I think the value in my head of the theoretical practice is very close to what you're saying. It's like, it's finding new lines of association from between us and like finding ways to bridge our disconnections, and to find a new space that's like, that is disconnected enough from the outside that it can function as a chamber for incepting something new. Mm-hmm. It's really that. It's the link between dreams and innovation that I think I'm thinking about. And this is, maybe to put a bow on it, this is the thing capital, you know, claims to want you to do, is to dream big and to innovate and to find a new way to do something, right? To make the world work, to make the world machine work better. But right. No one says who the world machine is for. Who is the global mega machine working for? You know what I mean? What is it? Who? I don't know. And the fact that it could be repurposed, the fact that all these things could be built differently. I think this is one of the things Guattari is saying about widgets, right? That like, instead of being locked into proprietary, you know, like boxes, black boxes, these technical implements could be opened up and form a huge open connective fabric that where different flows can be associated in different and new ways that make new assemblages possible. I don't know. That's in my head the point of the widget, is that it like it actually enables direct innovation by individuals. They don't have to buy it secondhand from a market who's like filtering out the results of deep science through a whole complicated design machinery. You know, you just open up, kind of open the factory, you know, like distribute the processes of production, which today would include cognitive processes and you know, we're never going to get those manufacturing jobs back. What we might get is extensive automation and the skills and technologies and disciplines around it. And extensive enough automation is very close to like a utopian kind of image where the machines just kind of work for themselves. And ideally we can skim off the top. You know what I mean? Ideally we can just equally distribute the results of things. But yeah, no, all that's hopefully in the future, if we make the right investments now, you know what I mean? Like if we find ways of like, you know, really making that possibility real and not getting caught up in the old dream and like fighting, you know, yesterday's problems. And, I don't know.
Well, that's,
but that was my, that there's like that politics and psychology are linked by this theme of association. But.
Yeah. It's interesting to circle around with you to this question of the dream. I mean, you brought up Descartes and Nietzsche, and, you know, for Descartes, it's an epistemological problem. As you pointed out, it's this, you know, in the dream, but also madness. And, you know, without going into Derrida and Foucault and their own discussions on this point, you know, for Derrida, it is this methodological question that doubt helps to resolve in doubting, you know, I think, but one never doubts once and for all. It is this iterative and reiterative process. With Nietzsche, I think that his discourse on hope sheds a new light on what the connotations of dreaming hold in terms of popular usage, because as you you pointed out earlier about capitalism wants us to dream big and all of these things. And I think that's where dreaming, you know, I mean, obviously for Freud as a process, as a process of production, the dream essentially fulfills a wish, except with very few circumstances where he can argue it can do the opposite and potentially do both at the same time, because the unconscious and negation have such a funny relationship. I mean, for Nietzsche, the way that the word dream gets used in modern day parlance is, it would more be akin to hope. And for Nietzsche, he wants us, as a psychologist, and especially a psychologist of idleness, and for Nietzsche, perhaps idleness is the one true content or phenomenon that psychologists should deal with. He wants us to be wary of hope insofar as it is a phenomenon of exhaustion or a phenomenon of a kind of unconnected kind of vital impulse that never actualizes, or that waits on some unannounced event to actualize itself in order for us to it's kind of a, it's a negation of the will to power. Right. And obviously for Nietzsche, will to power is not about gaining power in any sort of simple political sense. Right. But it is about right. the, you know, it is about, it is an ontological imperative, right. Of sort of increasing, I mean, it's increasing our potential, it's increasing our capacities, right? Our will to capacity. And so hope in a certain sense is a short circuit of that. And it is a way to, in a certain sense, it's, I think that even if for him it's, and it's more of a social than an individual thing, even though a lot of his aphorisms rail against hope on an individual scale, it's really about the social implications of hope that he rails against, because it's precisely the lever by which the dominant powers can subsume that force for their own will to power, and thereby disempower, disenfranchise, and turn that desire into a, against itself, into a reactionary force. So, yeah, I mean, I didn't mean to kind of go into a kind of a bleak or negative sense, but I think that Nietzsche wants us to be aware of the ways in which hope can, and in many ways is, this counter-revolutionary, reactionary, phenomenon that we have to sort of make sure that we analyze further, and that it doesn't just cover over like a band-aid the wounds that we are meant to to foster and to allow to fester, right? The wounds we are born for.
Yeah. Two tiny citations, maybe to put some final like undergirding here. So one is Chuang Tzu, and there's epigrams all through, like little quotes all throughout Lathe of Heaven, referencing Chuang Tzu. But probably the most notable thing that people might know is the tiny story of the Chuang Tzu dreams he's a butterfly and then wonders, right, whether or not he's the butterfly dreaming he's Chuang Tzu, or if he's Chuang Tzu dreaming the butterfly, right? And so it's about maybe the directionality of becoming, right, and how it's sort of difficult to know the limits of the dream, and again kind of encircling this problem of like actually circumscribing the dream. And I think the other tiny citation would be one to kind of make this point about the difference between what we might call like kind of the capitalist unconscious, or like kind of persistent hopefulness of change that like actually negates the possibility of it. With what Heraclitus says something beautiful about slumberers. He says that when you're sleeping, even sleepers, even the person who seems most cut off from the world, they're still helping the forms of the world come into existence. They're still hard at work making the world what it is and becoming what they are. And so there's something positive about the disconnection of, you know, your local transcendental structure of experience in the dream, you know, and there's a positive aspect to the dream work, you know, that is about forging and forming new lines of association that make new kinds of integrations possible. And give you a more comprehensive, capacious kind of approach to things, hopefully. And then maybe the will to power is a kind of a will to dream, not just to hope for a better, like different world, but to effectuate it, you know what I mean? To find the levers and the hooks, to use your cunning to determine a strategy.
Yeah, I think that's the right point, that if hope is not a passive sort of affect, if it is to become an active joy, it has to plug in into other realms of effectuation rather than its own type of self-endorsement of one's own misery, one could say, right? It's and to a certain extent, sometimes that, you know, hope might be the only thing left for certain people on the edge of slavery or whatnot. And I don't think that that's what he means. I think he's really referring to the extent to which so many people's lives are, you know, that's just a substitute, right? He doesn't want it to be an ersatz for he doesn't want it to be a substitute for engagement. And and you know, it's I think it's kind of a, you know, what he even calls hope, I think that others might not recognize it, but he diagnoses it, right, as a kind of a malaise, if you will, a kind of, you know, civilization and its discontents, right, one could say, right, that hope is this kind of substitute. I mean, partly you can see it in, again, to get back to kind of modern political parlance, this notion of that there's not haves and have-nots, there's haves and soon to haves, right? That kind of that kind of hope that capitalism fosters is that, oh, everyone's going to be a millionaire someday, you know. And that's kind of insidious.
It's exactly the same as like waiting in joyful hope for like a coming reward of the afterlife or something.
Yes,
like,
yes, that's right.
It scratches exactly the same psychological itch, and I think this is.
That's right.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. So I think it's a great place to close. If you're feeling good, or any last thoughts, or
sure. You know, I would suggest that to dissociate hopes and dreams. That essentially the dream produces something. It doesn't just mean something. Even if the analyst uses what the dream means, I mean, in the dream, you know, in the interpretation of dreams, it's not just about what the dream means specifically for the individual. It's about what the dream is doing, and that's really the Archimedean point. That's the lever that the analyst can use, and it can be used for better or worse. It can be used to neuroticize, or it can be used to unleash these potentially revolutionary unconscious investments. So it's all about how the dream works with its manifest and latent contents, etc. You know, it's always doing something. It's not just an image on a screen, right?
How to keep your dream machines in working order.
Mm-hmm.